Now you can teach to change lives. This is the second session of the Seven Laws of the Teacher series, part of the Applied Principles of Learning curriculum. Your speaker, Dr. Howard G. Hendricks, is a trailblazing Christian educator who practices what he preaches. A best-selling author, Dr. Hendricks is distinguished professor at Dallas Theological Seminary and chairman of the Christian Leadership Center there. In this message on the law of education, Dr. Hendricks will explain how to stimulate and direct your learners' self-activities. And now, Dr. Howard G. Hendricks.
Education is a process of passing from unconscious to conscious ignorance. Education is what's left over after you have forgotten the facts. That's why there are many courses that lead to a degree that never lead to an education, because we are focused on the wrong objective. I had to communicate with a seminary student some time ago, finally met him in the hall. He was in a trance on his way to an examination. I put my arm around him. He said, "Prof, don't touch me. I'll leak everything I know." Because, you see, testing is essentially a cramming meter. We're interested in how much the student can cram into his head and then regurgitate on a piece of paper. But this is not education. There are many people who have never seen the inside of a college or university, or have never been involved in formal training, who are brilliantly educated. They are men and women and young people of wisdom. They have received and are receiving an education. There are several areas that we want to penetrate this morning. First of all, I would like to give you a definition of this law. If you want to refine a concept, define it. We are defining the law of the teaching process, or the law of education, as we are calling it, as the process of exciting and directing the self-activities of the pupil. And, as a rule, telling him or her nothing that they can learn for themselves. Now, we don't want to spray the situation with words, so examine the concept. It's first of all a process of exciting and directing. There is the ignition phase and there is the steering phase. We've got to ignite and then channel. But notice, the key expression is the self-activity. The key to education is not what you do, but what the student does. And, please note, there are some exceptions, and we're going to spell them out. As a rule, tell the student nothing that that student can learn for himself. Now, this casts the teacher and the pupil into some very well-defined roles. You see, the teacher is primarily a stimulator. And the student is primarily an investigator. The teacher, properly understood, is primarily a motivator, a catalyst, if you please. The student is primarily a discoverer. And discovery learning is the most effective. To change the analogy to make a point, the teacher is primarily a coach. He does not play the game. He directs the players so that the pupil becomes the player. And therefore, I repeat, the ultimate test of teaching is not what do you do as a teacher, but what does the student do as a result of what you do. The second area that we want to look at are some exceptions. You will notice in the definition we said, as a rule, we are introducing you to some principles, some laws, some rules. And these are good analogies if you understand their limitations. Now I want to introduce you to four exceptions. Don't miss these. If you do, teaching will be a highly frustrating experience. Number one, there is an exception when your objective is to save time. Now watch that one, because it cuts both ways. It's a judgment call. You see, we want you to understand that teaching is both a science and an art. As a science, it involves basic laws. As an art, it involves knowing what the exceptions are. You see, there's no need to reinvent the wheel. If we are in a building and the building catches fire, this is not the time for a discussion. This is not the time to say, what do you think we ought to do? We want some warm feeling. This is a time for someone to say, where is the exit? And the same thing is true in good teaching. Secondly, there is an exception when you are confronted by certain types of students. And I want to introduce you to four of them. Number one, the beginning student. The beginning student always needs a great deal of encouragement. You see, it is so easy to destroy an individual. You get them in the process of learning, and it's so exciting, but they fail. Because failure is a part of the process of learning. But in the process of failing, it's easy for them to say, you know, I don't think I can make it. I flunked the first quiz. One of the most brilliant students I ever had, now a professor at the University of Chicago, and fast becoming the world's authority on the Hittite civilization, took a course from me one day in which he failed the course royally. He will tell you to this day it was the greatest learning experience of his life. So you want to make sure that what you are trying to do is to get a student involved in the process. It's a lot like learning to walk. I had four children, and as you can imagine, they were incredibly brilliant. You know how they learned to walk? Well, one day when they were in that pen behind bars, they looked out and watched somebody walk across the room. And they said to themselves, my, look at that amazing peripatetic action. I shall now proceed to walk. They got up and they've been walking ever since. You believe that? Of course you don't believe that. Because you've been down the road. You watch the little kid push himself up and look around, and finally he grabs a hold of the bars, and he gets up and wobbles and lets go of a hand, and zoom, down he goes. He's over there on the chair, and you say, come, Billy, and he starts coming, and pretty soon his legs get going faster than his bod, and he sprawls on the floor. And the kid says, shucks, I guess I never was called to walk. No, you see, he gets up, and he walks, and he falls, and he walks. And the more he learns to walk, the less he falls, but he never gets to the place where falling is not a live option. The second student that you need to keep in mind is a weak or discouraged student. And I'll tell you how to identify them. Frequently, they will hang around after class. And they will get you one-on-one. And they'll say, you know, I don't think I'm learning this. In fact, I'm not sure that I can really make it. Would you believe it if I told you that the number one problem in seminary today is the problem of inferiority feelings? And I was asked on a television program some time ago, you've been teaching in a seminary for 35 years, what have you learned? I said, I have learned that my primary task is communicating to the student, I believe in you. You're going to make it. So be very sensitive to that kid who says, you know, Mr. Brown, I don't think God could use me. I'd like to be a missionary. I'd like to be a lawyer, but I don't think I have it. Third, watch the older student. Now, ladies and gentlemen, older people are very good learners. But frequently, they are conditioned against learning. Because somewhere along the line, they were infected with the idea, you know, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. Which is true if you're teaching dogs. If you're teaching tricks. I'm not in the business of either one. I'm in the process of teaching people. A few years ago, we had a student at the seminary, 87 years of age, who finished the entire Hebrew and Greek program, both of which are very, very intensive. He got a slow start because, you know, he'd walk into class and say, well, hi, Dad, how are you today? You know, and all of these high chargers and fast-moving horses around him, and he began to think, you know, I guess I'm going to have some problems here. The truth of the matter is, he hung in there. And in a relatively short time, he exceeded those in the class. In fact, he turned out to be one of the best Greek and Hebrew scholars that we have ever turned out. Don't sell older people short. There is a fourth group, and there are many of you who have already shared with me. You're deeply involved in the process of working with that group. And that's disadvantaged people. Many of you are working in the inner city. Many of you are working with whites, with blacks, with Hispanics, with Orientals, with people who have a very deficient background by virtue of the context in which they were reared. Now, there are many people who superficially say, well, you know, these people are not as sharp. Don't you believe it? Some of the sharpest people in America are in our inner cities. They are simply handicapped people. And working with a young man who is now teaching in a university, a black man who came from the inner city, I said to him, tell me about your family. Well, he said, my family was greatly deprived. But you need to understand that as a result of someone who believed in us, today, there are three of us who have PhDs, and there are two of us who are resident scholars in two leading universities. Don't sell them short. But it may take some personal handling. Well, the first exception is when your objective is to save time. Secondly, when you are confronted by certain types of individuals. And I've suggested four. Third, when you have intense interest. Have you ever had this experience? If you haven't, you haven't lived. Have you ever had somebody so motivated that they can hardly contain themselves? Everything you feed them, they run with. I've got a guy like this. This guy played professional football, came to Christ. His life was radically changed. I said, have you got a Bible? He said, no. I said, let me get you one. All I could find at the time was a New Testament. I said, hey, read this thing. So a week later, he comes back and said, I read it. Well, I said, I know, but you want to continue to read it till you read the whole thing. No, he said, I read the whole thing, including the palms in the back. And he said, I understand there's another half, referring to the Old Testament. So I get him a whole Bible, and 4 weeks later, he comes back having read the Old Testament in its entirety. You know, I know elders in evangelical churches who have never read through the Bible once in their life. This is a guy so motivated, so turned on, that everything I feed him, he runs with just as fast as he can go. Fourth, When you have a resource individual, my father taught me some great lessons. One of the greatest was, son, whenever you get around a significant person, keep your mouth shut, except to ask penetrating questions. Pick their brain. Take advantage of what they have. But I never cease to be amazed how seldom we know how to use a resource individual. I've been flown all over America, paid a consultant's fee, only to sit in a group who spend the bulk of their time arguing with each other. I was in one some time ago. This guy finally hollered out, look, will the rest of you keep quiet? We can listen to you anytime without paying for you. We're paying this guy. Let's listen. And when he leaves, then we can interact with what he's got to say and do our arguing. You see, when you have a resource individual, when you have somebody who knows more than you know, that's the time when I want him or her to talk, to tell me everything they know. Well, there's a third area. We've defined the law. We have looked at the exceptions. Now I want to look at the goals. I was preaching in a church on the West Coast some time ago, moved my Bible on the lectern and exposed the sign which read, "What in the world are you trying to do to these people?" Now, you know, that has a way of derailing you. And after I got out, I said to the pastor, "What in the world is the purpose of the sign?" He said, "Hendricks, I have been preaching for 12 years without an objective. And it finally dawned on me one day, if I didn't know what I was doing, there was a good possibility they didn't know what they were supposed to do." So I started to come into the pulpit, to come into a teaching situation with clear-cut objectives. Do you have them? Do you know how to give a true education? Let me help you. Three things. Number one, people need to learn how to think. How to think. You see, if you want to change a person permanently, change their thinking, not their behavior. If you don't change a person's thinking, but merely his behavior, he will not know why he's doing what he's doing. Therefore, his action will be very superficial and usually short-lived. Now, if you're going to teach people how to think, this presupposes you know how, that you are involved in the process. Because your task as a teacher is to stretch the human mind. You see, the human mind is just like a muscle. It develops with usage. It deteriorates when it is not used. The human mind is like a rubber band. Once you stretch it, it will never return to its original form. Now, Christianity and evangelical Christianity in particular has been given a bad rap in this area. To many people, Christianity is the non-thinking person's filter. They think once they become a Christian, they put their head in a bucket and fire a 45 in it, that they are compelled to commit intellectual suicide. My friend, nothing could be further from the truth. Jesus said, you are to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. My friends, don't throw your mind into neutral. And whatever you do, make sure you are teaching your students how to think. Now, many of them are going to be afraid of this. They're scared to death they're going to strain their brain. I have students at the seminary. One in particular came to me some time ago and said, Prof, I was going to sign up for this course, but I understand it calls for too much thinking, and I can't do any more of that. I'm going to wear my brain out. I said, hey, I got wonderful news for you. I have a close friend in Philadelphia who's a pathologist. I said, have you seen a lot of brains? Hundreds of them. I said, you ever seen one worn out? He said, Hendricks, I've never seen one slightly used. So run the risk. 75% of the people in America never think. 15% of the people in America think they think. And only 10% really think? In which group are you? Now, we're not talking about rearranging your prejudices, which is what most people think thinking is. This is a very exacting process. It's a process of planting seeds. That's why we call it a seminary. Semin. It's a seed-planting institution where those seeds that are planted will germinate and eventually grow and bring forth fruit. When? You don't know. I want to give you a study, and that is to study Mark chapter 4 and the parable of the soil. Will you denote that there is only one variable in the parable? The seed is the same. The sower is the same. The only thing that changes is the soil. Because, you see, that's the key to the parable. It's not the sower. It's not the seed. It's the response of the listener. Let me recommend for you that you reflect upon the people who have marked your life. Many of you have been to high school, to college, to graduate school, and there was someone, maybe a few people, who so marked you that you've never been the same since. What I would recommend is that you analyze why was that true. I had a professor in college that changed the whole course of my life and my ministry, and upon reflection, it had nothing to do with the subject. It had everything to do with the person. A person who knew how to think and who had the incredible idea that he could teach me to do the same. And that's exactly what he did. Here's the second goal. We are not only interested in teaching people how to think, we are also concerned about teaching them how to learn. You see, if it's not primarily what the teacher does, but what the student does, then our task is to create learners who will perpetuate the learning process for the rest of their life. Let me give you three aspects to learning that you need to keep in the forefront of your thinking. Number one, learning is always a process. It's going on all the time. There's no such thing as coming into a classroom and saying, I shall now proceed to be learned. Every moment you live, you learn. Every moment you learn, you live. This is why some of the most exciting and fulfilled people you will ever meet are older people who have not stopped learning. That's what you are trying to do with individuals. We can paraphrase our law: if you stop learning today, you stop growing tomorrow. But secondly, learning is a logical process. It's a process that has three components. First of all, you begin with the whole. Then you move to the part. And finally, you come back to the whole. We call this synopsis. Nobody does it better than walk through the Bible. This is why this is one of the most unique ministries in America, because it puts things together. It gives you the big picture. And I've seen people in our churches who've been in the church all of their life and still don't know the name of the game, still don't know who's on first. And mind you, these are very sharp, articulate, capable individuals. So we begin, first of all, with a whole. Get the big picture. Then you break it down into the parts. This is what we specialize in. I was going to preach in a church some time ago. They said, Brother Hendricks, will you do us a favor? I said, if I can. They said, will you promise not to preach from Ephesians? And knowing the man as I do, I decided to josh him a little bit. And I said, well, you know, I never go to a church where they tell me what I can or cannot preach. Oh, no, 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 you don't understand. He said, we've been 3 years in Ephesians, and we're just into the second chapter. That's par for the course. This is why most people in our churches end up with 12 baskets of fragments. Because we never move from the big picture to the analysis of the parts, and then, to go back to the whole. And that's what we call synthesis. The best learning takes place when you first of all see the big picture. Then when we break it down, the parts take on meaning in light of the whole. So we put it back together for you so that you can walk out the door saying, that's what I now understand and can use. It's not only a process, it's not only a logical process, it's a discovery process. Truth is always most profitable and most productive when you can see it for yourself. Taught a class for professional men, had a doctor in that class. This guy got so excited about studying the Bible, he was like a kid with a fire engine. Met his wife on the parking lot one day at the church. He said, what in the world are you doing to my husband? I said, why? What's the matter with it? She said, I got to set the alarm clock to tell this guy what time to go to bed at night. He's so deeply involved in the Word. You know, as it is throughout the community. Ladies and gentlemen, believe me, this is why the average person in our evangelical church is not excited by the truth. They are embalmed by the truth because they have never had the life-changing experience of saying, hey, that's what God said. That's what He wants me to do. Somebody's got to hear about it. And have the same experience of changed life that I can do. That's discovery learning, the name of the game. And I believe the average educational program in our conservative churches is an insult to the intelligence of the people involved. We're giving people wilted, cut flowers instead of teaching them how to grow by means of the Word, which is alive. There is a third objective. We want them to learn how to think. We want them to learn how to learn. We also want them to learn how to work. I want to give you a sub-principle, and that is, never do anything for a student which the student is capable of doing for himself. Never do anything for a student which the student is capable of doing for himself. If you do, you will make him or her an educational cripple, a pedagogical paraplegic. And it is my conviction, we are doing too much for our students. Now, I want to give you a question. It's going to be a little convicting, so fasten your safety belt. Are you one of the culprits? Are you a part of the problem, or are you working on the solution? You see, your task is to develop people who are self-directed, who are disciplined, who do what they do because they choose to do it. And that's why I would suggest you need to spend more time questioning answers rather than answering questions. We are developing a larger core of people who know what they believe, but don't have a clue as to why they believe it. Our task is not to give quick and easy answers and patent medicine solutions that do not work in the realities of life. My classes, the thing that burdens me is not students who come out with loose ends. The thing that turns me on is students who come out with live ends. And if you have students coming out of your classes scratching their heads, asking questions, trying to solve problems, spend the rest of the week in applying this truth and come back next week and say, hey, you know, I tried to do this, but it didn't work. Why? And then you have an opportunity, probably, to help them find some of the greatest solutions to life's problems. Now, if you're going to teach students to think and to learn and to work, there are four basics you're going to have to work with. Number one, you're going to have to teach them to read. My friend, the number one need in the evangelical church today is people who read. And I'm going to make a prophecy. Since we're putting it down on tape, you can hold me to it. You know what they did with prophets in the Old Testament when the prophecies didn't come true? Collect your stones. It is my judgment that within the next 10 to 15 years, you in your evangelical church or your discipling ministry will have to spend more time in remedial reading, maybe offering courses in your church. You see, this is a revelation. What good is a revelation if you can't read it? That's why wherever missionaries go, the first concern they have is to teach people how to read. We have Bible classes in Dallas in the most sophisticated sections, and we do not dare to call unto the people to read. Because here's the CEO of a company, but he can't read. Reading is a basic skill if you're going to teach thinking, if you're going to teach people how to learn, how to work. Secondly is writing. Give your students opportunities to express themselves. Some of the most exciting times I have with young people. I give them creative assignments. I want you to write some music and some lyrics. You see, what do we do in our churches? We damn the music that the kids listen to. We have these ridiculous sessions of burning records, and the kids roar on the inside. Ladies and gentlemen, you cannot prohibit without providing. It's not enough to say, don't do that, unless you say, do that. And we need to give kids an opportunity to write. We're finding kids who are incredibly gifted in the realm of writing poetry. We're periodically seeing it appear in magazines, in newspapers, where an editor comes across something written by a 12-year-old kid, puts it on the editorial page. Third, you need to teach your pupils to listen. Now, that's a very difficult skill. And isn't it interesting? You can't get out of many colleges without having a course in speech, but you can get out of 99% of them without having a course in listening. Though Harvard Business Review informs us that the average executive in America spends 70% of his time listening. See, we are not teaching people how to listen, and furthermore, we don't model it. You see, if you are a teacher, you think your task is to talk. This is why a lot of people say to me, I can't talk, so I can't teach. I say, don't you talk very well? No, good. You're just the person I'm looking for. Can you listen? Oh, yeah, man, I can listen. And the little kid sitting on the edge of his chair with his guy thinks this guy hung the moon because for the first time in his life, he found an adult who can listen. And fourth, you need to teach people to speak, to get on their feet. When I was a young person in Philadelphia, both my wife and I had the greatest training in a group called Christian Endeavor. And one of the greatest things about that organization is that you never win a Sunday without getting on your feet. And people have often asked me, you know, where did you learn to speak? Did you take a course? Yeah, I took a course and it didn't hurt. But I'll tell you what I did. I had a lot of experience. And by the way, you parents need to do that with your kids. See, get them on their feet in your home. They're just three, four, five of you. Get them up in front talking.
And people say, how in the world do you get kids out of a home? All of your kids know how to speak because everyone from one, two on was a person on his feet. You see, you learn to speak by speaking. And we need to take these kids out to the local jail and to the hospital and to other opportunities where they get an opportunity to articulate their faith. We need to get adults who are working at the office to start a Bible study. And they say, man, I don't know enough about the Bible. Good. Are you interested in learning? Oh, yeah. Then you can be a great teacher because you will be involved in the process with them. When I first went to Texas a number of years ago, I will never forget being in West Texas and making a stupid statement. I said, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. And I will never forget this tall Texan coming up afterwards and saying, son, you're wrong. You can feed him salt. I want to ask you one question. Anybody ever walk out of your class so thirsty they can hardly wait to get the next drink for themselves?
You've been listening to Dr. Howard G. Hendricks, professor, author, and Christian educator, speaking on the law of education. This cassette tape message is part of the Applied Principles of Learning curriculum developed by Walk Through the Bible. Other materials are available to help you get the most from this life-changing series on the seven laws of the teacher, including a seven-part video series, course notebook, video leader's guide, and course textbook by Dr. Hendricks. At Walk Through the Bible, we're committed to helping you become a master communicator. We also offer an innovative companion series, The Seven Laws of the Learner, featuring Dr. Bruce H. Wilkinson, president and founder of Walk Through the Bible Ministries and a nationally known Bible teacher. For information on this series, which features a course notebook, teacher's notebook, and full-color teaching overheads, contact Walk Through the Bible Ministries at Post Office Box 80587, Atlanta, Georgia, 30366. Or telephone us at area code 404-458-9300. Walk Through the Bible. Called to minister for life change.